most important species, most important commercially to us, are salmon, herring, tanner crabs, and there's a pot shrimp fishery, which also occurs in the Sound. And I'd like to mention also that we have an infant oyster mariculture operation in the Sound as well. In 1988, the total value for these fisheries was approximately $84 million. Cordova was ranked number 8 in the value of seaports delivered nationwide, and Cordova receives the lion's share of the fisheries in Prince William Sound. Now, approximately 85% of the total value, 85% of this $84 million, which fishermen received in 1988, 85% of that is based upon salmon. And in our area, we have 5 species of salmon. I'm going to concentrate my remarks upon Prince William Sound fisheries and neglect the gillnet fisheries, which are on the Copper River Delta and the Bering River, because those areas are not directly impacted by the spill of the Exxon Valdez. So in Prince William Sound, we have a fishery which is probably 90% based upon pink salmon. There are 2 gear types. There's a seine fishery and also three gear types, the purse seine fishery, a drift gillnet, and a set gillnet fishery, which all occur sometimes at different times in the Sound, but sometimes overlapping. Now, the pink salmon, which is really the bread and butter of the Sound fisheries, occur in basically two stocks or two groups of fish. We have wild stocks and then hatchery enhanced stocks. The wild stocks are often subject to perturbations of the environment, particularly harsh freezes in wintertime, which has sometimes drastic effects upon freezing and killing of fry and eggs in the stream prior to their emergence in the spring. And there's another serious environmental threat, and that is the possibility of washouts by severe rainstorms in the fall. So consequently, wild stocks as a basis for fisheries is a sometimes thing. It's not a steadily reliable resource. And back in, 1974, there was an attempt, a program started to enhance the wild stocks through the hatchery program. There was an enhancement vision, that is, we can, fishermen and fishing game personnel at the time envisioned aid to the natural stocks by development of an enhancement program. And over the 14 years of existence of the hatchery program, we've seen great success. So that now, in looking at the 1989 pre-spill forecast, we're looking at a value of $126 million of harvestable fish, mostly pink salmon. Approximately 50%, a little bit greater than 50% of this total was based upon hatchery enhanced fish. This stock of pink salmon in Prince William Sound, and other species as well, the chum salmon or sockeye salmon as well as coho salmon, these fish have all been put in some degree of jeopardy by the spill. And I'd just like to mention what we perceive as some short-term and long-term effects here of the spill. We've been told, emphatically we've been told, that we're going to have a normal fishery this summer. And I think your gentlemen will concur with me that we'll have anything but a normal fishery this summer. As was mentioned earlier, one of our main concerns is to produce and maintain high-quality fish, to maintain the markets we've had, to ensure the consumer that we have a good quality fish. To do this, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation are working hand in hand with fishermen to set aside areas which will be contamination free. And we're looking at the possibility of reduction of about 50% of the total area of the sound. Fortunately, the breadbasket of the sound, which is up in the northern shores and the eastern and southeastern side of the sound, has been not impacted, at least nowhere near. Let me just say that the impact in these in the northern district has been minimal, and we believe it's quite clean. So fishing will presumably take place in reduced area. We're looking at a reduction of about 50% of our fishing area within the sound. So this is anything but a normal situation. And there is also the further conflict of gear, a dissimilar gear conflict, which is also to occur in this in portions of this 50% of the area which will be open to fishing. We have looked at options for handling the harvest this summer. One is to proceed in the normal, very competitive fashion, and the other is to examine the possibility for a co-op where there'll be perhaps fewer catcher boats and the proceeds of the entire catch will be divided among the members of the fleet. But I'm sure you'll agree that this presents can present a great deal of difficulty in working out the nuts and bolts. But generally, I think there's a favorable agreement to the concept of a co-op fishery. Another short-term concern of ours, aside from a concern for our markets and quality of fish, reduction of fishing area, is also the problem of gear contamination. We know a large number of our fishing boats have been involved in a spill cleanup effort. These boats need to be decontaminated and certified as clean by Department of Environmental Conservation, and boat cleaning stations, and contingency for fouled gear, cleanup of fouled gear, is also one of our concerns in the short-term view. Long-term effects that we can address some concern about have to do with direct oiling of spawning streams. Some of the streams in the southwest district of the sound, which has been one of the major, probably the major corridor for exit of oil out of the sound, portions of this area have been heavily hit by oil. Oil has been seen right in the beds of spawning streams. We have been told by Fish and Game that 30% of the area that spawning streams, the natural spawning streams occur, will be off limits to fishing. That is, will not be able to harvest the fish in this heavily impacted area, even if the fish were in good shape. So we're concerned on a long-term basis with oiling of streams, direct oiling of streams, direct oiling of presence of oil in the sediments. We're also concerned with oil on the beaches. It has been presented in the different reports. We receive what we call a Cordova fact sheet on a daily basis, in which reports findings from different scientists and agencies on a daily basis. And one of the reports mentioned here cites that the plankton in Prince William Sound has not been heavily impacted by the oil. Now, for us as fishermen, we have to be concerned with what does this mean for the release of juvenile pink salmon, which is occurring this time of the year. The behavior of pink salmon is such that when a fry are released, they don't spend a great deal of time in open waters immediately, but rather they spend weeks in the shallows, in coves, along secluded shores, in shallow water. The presence of oil on a beach and also the presence of oil in the sediments, I think, is cause for great concern for the for these fish from a number of aspects. There have been laboratory studies done with crude oil, or fractions of crude oil, which show there can be direct morphological changes in juvenile fish, especially damages done to the olfactory areas, which we know salmon rely upon for homing back to their natal streams. So there's a possible suggestion of morphological and perhaps physiological changes in the smelling ability of these fish as juveniles, which, who knows, may carry over to their adult life as well. Yes, okay. Well, one other concern here we have, aside from what I mentioned, is the possible contamination of food organisms, particularly herpactocoid copepods, which are benthic crustacea, which are not addressed in the plankton in the water column. These are food items, important food items for juvenile fry, which are living in shallows. We don't know what effect the heavily oil will have, heavily oiling of sediments will have upon these benthic crustacea. And we have just one further concern here I'd like to mention. That's with regard to this juvenile or infant oyster mariculture operation, which has begun in Prince William Sound. We know that the Amoco Cadiz report, studies on the Amoco Cadiz biota, show that there are long-term damages. That hydrocarbons can be detected in oysters and fish over long periods of time. We're very much concerned about that. And finally, I'd just like to say that another long-term effect here is the expression of solidarity and concern from other areas in the country for the plight we have, because what happens in Prince William Sound is certainly very possible, very likely in other areas. As long as we have coastlines with tanker transport, we're in jeopardy. Thank you.
Thank you. Slam.
That was Ken Adams of Cordova District Fishermen United. Next, Jack Lamb, who's been one of the coordinators of the CDFU effort.
Mr. Chairman, gentlemen, I thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony to this subcommittee. My name is Jack Lamb. I'm a member of Cordova District Fishermen United. I'm currently vice president of that organization. My testimony tonight will refer to my involvement on CDFU's behalf in the oil spill and its response activities. My involvement began on the morning of March 24th at approximately 7 a.m. when I received a phone call that informed me that a tanker had gone aground on Bly Reef. The initial impact at that particular moment couldn't be registered, just other than the fact that if a tanker had significantly gone aground on Bly Reef, there was going to be major amounts of oil in Prince William Sound. Immediately, I contacted two key people within CDFU, our executive director, Marilyn Leland, and Dr. Ricciotti, who sits beside me. The primary thing that we began was to enumerate a list of vessels that would be available on a moment's notice to assist in whatever manner necessary to try to deal with this obvious spill. By 9 o'clock in the morning, we still did not have a significant size other than of the spill, other than the amount of oil that was being gushed out. At approximately 9 o'clock in the morning, the estimates were between 175 and 200,000 barrels had already been disgorged into Prince William Sound. And Dr. Ott was in an airplane overflying the scene, and we were hoping for reports back from her. During the course of the day, many of the other fishermen, spotter pilots and fishermen, overflew the site, brought back videos, VCR recordings of the size of the spill at different times. We established a chart within the office there of Prince William Sound showing the growth of the spill on approximately 2 hour by 2 hour basis until about between four and 5 o'clock in the afternoon of that day. As the day continued on, the list of vessels increased to a number of approximately 50 that were available at a moment's notice, or could be very, very quickly. At about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we received a phone call from Gary Komkoff from the village of Tetlik, which was in a straight line less than 10 miles from the tanker spill, indicating that they had another 15 vessels available And if they had gone through the same exercise that we had been going through all day long, and that was attempting to contact some entity in Valdez to let them know these vessels were available at their disposal upon their mere request. All through the day and on into the evening, we never had any response back, in fact, from our office in Cordova, other than, I believe, one phone call that was answered, that was picked up. The call was received. It was made by Marilyn Leland, our executive director, and which simply gave her another phone number to call at Alyeska, and we never were able to get all the way through to Alyeska. I don't know of any kind of phone conversation that took place with Alyeska on that day. As we went into the evening, we had some reports from Dr. Ott as to what was taking place, that also that there was going to be a governor's press conference that evening that would be aired by the local public broadcasting radio system, KCHU. We stayed in the office till late that evening listening to the conference as it took place. As the conference came to a close in the discussions between our executive director and myself, it became apparent that some additional force was going to have to be generated in Valdez, and it was decided that I would come to Valdez on the following day, which was Saturday. On Saturday, day two, I boarded an airplane, a light plane from Cordova at approximately 10:15 in the morning, flew to Valdez by way of the spill. By that time, there had been a designated restriction for flying over the spill area, which gave a circumference of about 6 miles, a diameter of about 6 miles. So rather than go through all the preliminaries to get permission to fly directly over it, we've overflew the edge of that zone to observe what was taking place. My observations at that time, which was between 10:30 in the morning and 11 o'clock on the second day, approximately 34 and a half hours after the spill, or after the grounding of the vessel, the observation showed a small contingency of vessels in the immediate area of Bly Reef Light buoy, which we could not identify their action. They were grouped together and didn't seem to be anything actually taking place. There was a tanker alongside of the Exxon Valdez and a tug alongside of that one. The tug was attached by its bow to the stern of the assisting tanker, and that was on the west side of, or the west side of the group of vessels. Hanging from his stern was a single boom flowing directly downstream out towards the middle of the sound, and that was the only type of boom assembly that I could observe at all in flying by there. We continued on into Valdez, my purpose being to attend the press conference that was to take place Saturday at about 11 o'clock in the morning. Fortunately, it was postponed a bit, and I was able to be here for the entire press conference on Saturday. It was postponed until, I believe, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. In sitting in on a press conference, the entities involved with Coast Guard, Alyeska, and Exxon, and sitting through it, just mostly to try to gain some information as to what had taken place, we heard that boom had been deployed and had surrounded the vessel, which I pointedly refuted from my previous flight of less than 2 hours hence. And my next questions were directed to the Coast Guard in reference to what kind of explanation they had for a vessel of that size, that magnitude, being so far out of its designated traffic lane as to actually be outside of the designated navigable waters by Coast Guard lights on a night which was crystal clear with no winds or anything else. I felt that I did not receive an answer to that question. We continued on through the day, and as the evening press conference took place late in the evening, it was postponed until somewhere between 7:30 and 8 o'clock. We were then told that boom had finally been deployed around the tanker and that skimming operations were underway. Considering all the other things that had taken place, we were very skeptical about that having taken place. Going on into the next day, day three, Sunday, which had been March 26th, the morning press conference had been very brief. They had attempted to do some dispersant tests the previous evening, late in the evening, with the helicopter, I believe it was. The helicopter attempt was done on Friday evening, the very first evening, with unsuccessful results. They did it again on Saturday evening with a C-130, at which they had a very difficult time hitting the target. In fact, I believe that was the time in which they did an excellent job of approaching the tanker and the people on board there with the dispersants. continuing on through Sunday into the afternoon, it became obvious that the winds out of the north were increasing. Not that we could feel them here in Valdez so much, but if you look at the mountains around about, the snow was blowing off the tops of the mountains. And for those of us that live in this area, we know what those signs foretell. They foretell some fairly strong winds. And as we continued on through the day and into the evening conference, they again were attempting to do a dispersant test. All of this was in Zone 1, pre-approved by the state of Alaska under the discretion of the Coast Guard. And these dispersant tests up to this point, at the press conference of Sunday evening, they said that they were unable to determine the success of the attempts because it had gotten so late in the evening, and would attempt to report to us sometime the next morning's conference, press conference, as to how successful they had been. The winds were kicking up, and they felt that that was to an advantage in using the dispersants. The next morning, also at the same time at the close of that conference that evening, we were approached by the Department of Fish and Game Habitat Division and assured that we would be consulted as the fishing entity here in Prince William Sound representing them. We would be consulted before any kind of decision would be made in the use of dispersants in zones 2 or 3. The next morning, the winds continued at a high rate, in excess of 50 miles an hour out of the north. Consequently, there was no ability to fly, and so everything was canceled for the morning. During that morning, which was Monday morning, one of the individuals with me, Jeff Gard, the two of us spent a large portion of the morning using Alyeska's contingency plan and suggested use of dispersants, and the numbers that they generate in there for the successful use of dispersants, to try to determine, based on what we had been reported to the previous evening, of having 50,000 gallons of dispersant available, that we would use that as a number, using Alyeska's contingency plan and their numbers, to determine how successful and to what extent dispersants would have success, total success, on the spill. And by using their numbers and cranking it all back together, which took us quite a while with calculators and so forth, we found that if they were able to use the 50,000 gallons of dispersant that was available to them at that particular time, and the spill was in an ideal situation for the use of dispersants, that amount of dispersant would be successful on approximately 9.5% of the spill. That's what was available. Monday afternoon, we were coming to a press conference, which again had been postponed. Also, at the time of the postponing of the press conference, I was made available, or it was made known to me that approval for use of dispersants in Zone 3 had been granted. And to my knowledge, we had not been consulted. I purposely headed for the state offices to get very point blank about the lack of communication. Upon reaching the state offices and talking with the fish and game personnel there that had talked with me the previous evening, I'd been told that Theo Matthews, who had also joined us here from United Fishermen of Alaska, was the only person I could contact. He had also been involved with the Glacier Bay spill in Cook Inlet. He had granted his approval, his understanding. I didn't argue with that, and I calmed down considerably. We sat down to talk about what was taking place, and about 5 o'clock in the evening, Bill Lamoureux from DEC came in, indicating that he had just overflown the spill site and that it had moved in its entirety approximately 35 miles to the south and somewhat to the east, to the west, concentrating primarily around Naked Island, Smith Island, and the northern portion of Eleanor Island. With that understanding there, with fish and game, we began to look at some alternative methods of protecting sensitive areas, which we at that time determined to be Montague Island. A little later, about an hour and a half later, another individual came in indicating that the spill was now making a large bubble to the west between Night Island and Eleanor Island, and that there was a large chance of impact in those areas over there as well. By that time, a couple of other individuals had joined me who were working with us, Rick Steiner and David Grimes. We began to look at this thing from an absolute worst-case scenario. Worst-case scenario, what's our position? Our position was there are 4 areas on the west and southwest segment of Prince William Sound that have to be protected at all costs. We identified 3 hatchery sites, Esther Island Hatchery Site, Main Bay Hatchery Site, the Armin F. Corning Hatchery Site in Sawmill Bay, and also the East Chamois District. The East Chamois District being a very sensitive sockeye salmon natural reserve that has been worked at long and hard to restore, and we felt it was necessary to protect that also. A bit later in the evening, about 7 o'clock, we were made aware then in that conference room that a two-level committee system was being put together. A steering committee headed by three individuals, Mr. Dennis Kelso, Commissioner of ADEC, Admiral Nelson of the Coast Guard, and Frank Iarossi of Exxon. They came into the conference room with a large number of people. I can't remember the exact number that finally filled that conference room, and identified a second committee, which was considered an operations committee, and a group was named to serve on that committee. They included the state agencies, the federal agencies, the Coast Guard, and CDFU. And we began to approach the idea of what to do. Again, we went through the scenario of what needed to be protected. I think that for most of us, we decided to be immediately that Knights Island, Eleanor Island, and Disk Island, Ingot Island, that little group there, in itself, okay, would have to be sacrificed. So we went on. The next thing we need to do is get boom to those areas that need to be protected. And they asked if we could get vessels. I pointedly told them that yes, we had vessels available since Friday. They said, how soon? I said, now. That was about 9 o'clock in the evening. By 10 o'clock, we had 8 vessels underway. By 9 o'clock the next morning, we had an additional 7. They went to the sites. The booms were being sent out by vessels, dispatched out of Valdez. The first boom was deployed at East Chamois and then at Main Bay. What was left went to Esther. At that point, that looked like that was the key. Very quickly, we found that with the currents and so forth and the winds that were changing a little bit to be in the northwest, that Sawmill Bay was a major key. Getting boom to Sawmill Bay was very difficult. The hatchery system, PSWAC, on their own, ordered some boom, got some boom delivered to them on their own. It was put in place as immediate containment boom, went on their immediate fry pens in Sawmill Bay, and the boats were available. To continue to get boom was a push. We were learning that boom was not as readily available as we were led to believe. Tuesday was a long day, and Tuesday evening I and Dr. Ott were recalled back to Cordova. So it was Wednesday afternoon the evening before we got back, and we continued on in a scenario. We were told at the operations meeting on Wednesday evening that boom and skimmers were on their way. Boom and skimmers were on their way. We wanted to know where and when, and we couldn't get specific times and dates. I mean, they were on the way and they were coming as quickly as they could. Getting boom to Sawmill Bay was something of a chore. We wound up getting some more on our own, and we did get some brought down from Esther that had been originally deployed up there. Sawmill Bay, I'll continue to refer to the area of Sawmill Bay because it's the one that is most recognized. It's the Armin Koning hatchery at Sawmill Bay. Sawmill Bay became the main target of the oil. It was the one that was at greatest threat in those first week and a half. It was determined very quickly, approximately on, I believe it was Thursday afternoon, that oil spill experts, both from Exxon, DEC, and the hatchery, all agreed that they needed stronger and better boom. And it was made known where they could acquire it, and they had made the attempts to find it. I was called by PSWAC and asked if I could help facilitate getting the boom. I indicated to them at that time that I would make every effort, but that it would probably take at least 24 hours to get it into motion. Fortunately, it only took about 18 hours. However, once we identified the boom and the necessity for it, getting it there was another thing. It took nearly an additional week for that boom to fully be deployed in place with large degrees of success. The success in keeping the hatchery clear was a combination of the fishermen's effort by using boom as deflection type material and their vessels, a ferry project, I'll call it the ferry project because it combined both the Bartlett and the Aurora, the Bartlett first, which then became the Aurora project, that there in the people that they brought in with skiffs and small booms, and also a sucker system, super sucker. This might sound a little ridiculous, but that's an object that's a truck that has capability of sucking oil out of the water. Okay. But we continued to try to make every effort we could. Everything that was done because we sat on the operations committee and said, this has to be done, this has to be done, this has to be done. And they said, we got stuff coming, we've got stuff coming, we've got stuff coming. And stuff kept coming. But trying to get it deployed with any degree of success was almost impossible. The logistics on it were pathetic. And I'm sorry, but that's the true terminology. As they went through the second week there, trying to get things done became so frustrating, it was unbelievable. I think perhaps that the best statement that was made to identify what took place was made by Mr. Frank Iarossi himself when he was preparing to leave at a press conference. And he made the statement that Exxon had done everything that the fishermen and Jack Lamb asked him to do. And the statement is absolutely correct. The finish of the statement is that it's the only thing they did. We were not oil spill people. We're fishermen. We're not experts in recovering oil. They are. And yet no initiative was taken on their part. Every time something needed to be done, it was identified by us and pushed by us. It was very frustrating. And as we started looking at it a little farther, then we began to wonder, you know, what happened to Alyeska? Alyeska is the entity we've got to continue to deal with. It's their contingency plan, and yet on day three, Exxon took over formally, and Alyeska hasn't been heard of. And yet we still have to deal with them. So we're working our best with DEC and the other agencies to get the input that we feel is necessary so that we can be protected from this ever happening again. And if I might, this deviates just a little bit, but a question was asked a little bit ago of Commissioner Kelso, referencing 241 years before, you know, once every 241 years a spill of this place takes place. And a thought came to mind that refers to bears in Alaska. And that is that you only get attacked by one bear out of every 100, but they don't come in numerical order. With that, I think I'll go ahead and close my testimony and let Dr. Ott continue. I'll be more than happy to answer any questions in any way that I can. Thank you.
My name is Ricky Ott. I'm a Cordova resident and fisherwoman. I own a salmon drift gillnet permit, and I have fished Prince William Sound for 4 years. My training is in marine toxicology. I have a master's in oil pollution and a doctorate in sediment pollution. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Cordova District Fishermen United and the United Fishermen of Alaska as a member of the board of directors. On behalf of the fishing industry, I wish to thank Chairman Miller for holding this field hearing. I also wish to thank Mr. Miller and his staff for their interest and concern regarding Alyeska operations prior to the oil spill. I've been working with Miller's staff for over 1 year on Alyeska issues and visited his staff in Washington, D.C. in February of this year. I understand this hearing is to be the first of a series of hearings on the oil spill and Alyeska operations. In that case, I am looking forward to continuing our working relationship until these issues are resolved. In Prince William Sound, fishermen and oilmen have a long history. As early as 1971, fishermen were concerned that our fishing grounds and our fisheries would suffer from operations and accidents at the proposed Valdez tanker terminal and along the marine leg of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. That year, a CDFU delegation testified on these concerns before a subcommittee of the House Merchant Marine and Fisheries Committee. As early as 1971, oilmen were telling congressmen and fishermen to trust us. That year, Alyeska spokesman testified before the Department of Interior and promised that the best equipment, materials, and expertise, which will be made available as part of the oil spill contingency plan, will make operations at Port Valdez and in Prince William Sound the safest in the world. But fishermen didn't buy it. CDFU filed a suit to prevent the TAPS terminus from being located in Port Valdez. While the suit was successful, the fishermen were overruled when Congress passed special legislation authorizing the Department of Interior to grant the right-of-way to the pipeline owner companies allowing construction of TAPS in Alyeska. Since startup in 1977, fishermen have become increasingly aware and critical of problems developing with the Alyeska terminal. In 1985, CDFU and Virginia oil broker Charles Hamill filed notice of intent to sue over alleged mismanagement of the ballast water treatment plant, resulting in violations of state and federal environmental permits. Since then, we have been working actively together to resolve these problems. On March 23, 1989, as keynote speaker, I spoke to the Valdez community about the problems at Alyeska. I warned the community that the probability of an oil spill in Prince William Sound was very high. Given the high frequency of tankers into Port Valdez, the increasing age and size of the tanker fleet, and the inability to quickly contain and clean up an oil spill in open waters of Alaska, the fishing industry knew we were playing a game of Russian roulette. On March 24, 1989, with the grounding of the Exxon Valdez and resulting release of 10.5 million gallons of crude oil into Prince William Sound, the seven oil companies who own Alyeska broke a contract with the United States government and the people of the state of Alaska. Simply put, Alyeska was unprepared to deal with an oil spill of this magnitude, as they promised they would be, and they failed to react quickly during the critical early hours of the spill to minimize environmental damage, as they are mandated to do. But the oil spill only served to highlight a history of broken promises by the Seven Sisters at Alyeska. At the Alyeska terminal, one will discover that the terminal was not built the way Congress approved it to be built, that the terminal was not maintained the way state and federal permits say it is to be maintained, and that the terminal was not reviewed and upgraded every 5 years as Congress intended it to be. And this is only the tip of the iceberg. There have been cutbacks in the oil spill response team, cutbacks in the best available technology, and cutbacks in the terminal repairs. While the Seven Sisters were busy cutting back on all the oil pollution control systems, they were also busy cutting a profit of $12.4 billion since startup. And now Alyeska, on one hand, tells us they plan to make extensive use of existing treatment and disposal facilities at Alyeska to dispose of thousands of tons of oily waste from the oil spill. And they intend to do so in an environmentally sound manner. Congressman, we have heard this all before. On the other hand, Alyeska has applied for a site-specific reduction in the state's water quality standards in eastern Port Valdez, and they are fighting the regulatory agencies tooth and nail over the new discharge permits, which will supposedly eventually replace the very outdated 1980 permits. Incidentally, the problem may not lie solely with the oil industry. I discovered in 1987 at the EPA public hearing for the NPDES permit that EPA had classified Alyeska as a nonprofit organization and based their entire permit on that. When operations at Alyeska Terminal are compared to other operations at facilities which handle oil and chemicals, including facilities partly owned by the Alyeska owner companies, it becomes readily apparent that the oil industry as a whole is operating under a global set of double standards. Furthermore, when compared to other facilities, the Alyeska terminal is in many ways substandard. If Alyeska is an example of how the oil industry operates in an environmentally sound manner, what are they doing in even more remote areas with even less supervision? What are they doing along the 800-mile pipeline on the North Slope? What would they do in Anwar or in Bristol Bay? Using public waterways as receiving waters and to transport oil is a privilege, not a right. The oil industry has broken their contract with the people of the nation, and they have violated our trust. It is time to change their methods of operation. The attitude of the oil industry, on the other hand, does not appear to have changed one iota since the Exxon Valdez spill. Look at the attitude of Amoco towards drilling in the Beaufort Sea. On April 3rd, 10 days after the Exxon Valdez disaster, Amoco filed an appeal with the Secretary Mosbacher protesting the state of Alaska's authority to review its oil spill contingency plan. While Alaska fishermen fought to save our livelihoods, Amoco was in Washington, D.C., saying they should be allowed to proceed unfettered by the state because of national security interests in finding new domestic oil reserves. Congressman, this flagrant display of irresponsibility and lack of commitment by the oil industry to the people of Alaska and the nation has got to stop. Last year, a single sockeye salmon was worth more than a barrel of oil. But salmon are more than just money to the fishing industry. These fish are the lifeblood of many communities within Prince William Sound and most other rural coastal Alaskan communities. The fishing industry is not against the oil industry. We only request now, as we have all along, responsible development of resources. This includes a firm commitment from industries that have the potential to impact the water quality and environment to minimize this impact. It includes a firm commitment from the resource agencies that permit compliance will be strictly enforced by thorough monitoring of operations. And it includes a firm commitment from Congress that compliance with its stipulations and promises will be strictly monitored and enforced. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Comments by Ricky Ott, preceded by Jack Lamb and Ken Adams, all of the CDFU organization.
When I was visited with people in Sawmill Bay, aboard the Aurora and around the bay, at that particular time, there was both complaints about the size of the booms with respect to strength. I think that was the discussion, not the depth of the booms, although that was of some concern also. But the strength of the booms, and also the fact that a number of the skimmers were more or less constantly out of commission or had substantial downtime because of their inability to offload oil. Did that continue for any period of time? Or was that more?
That really did continue for quite a period of time, and not just in the area of Sawmill Bay. It was first presented in Sawmill Bay. The difficulty was that there was no system available at the time with Exxon to pump the oils out of the skimmers once they were filled with oil into the barges.
Do the skimmers have self-contained pumps, onboard pumps?
I honestly don't know about the onboard pumps on the skimmers themselves.
Is that why you brought in the Super Sucker, the truck that was out there?
No, the Super Sucker was our own experiment to begin with. That was something that was dreamed up.
But that was used later to then offload
when everything came together at Sawmill Bay, and they, would have been day 9, Saturday, a week after the spill, the Super Sucker was in place. And when the skimmers found that they couldn't be pumped off by the normal methods being exercised by Exxon at the time, they went over to the Super Sucker to see if they would have any success there, because there was the capacity with the truck, the Super Sucker truck, and the vessel it was on, to take the oil out of the skimmer, allow it to go back to work quickly, and store the oil on board the vessel that the Super Sucker was mounted on.
So, but for the Super Sucker system, it's getting outrageous here. those skimmers would have had the ability to pick up whatever their capacity, which was how many barrels of oil?
The Mark 5s and Mark 7s, I believe, was 30 to 32 barrels of oil.
They could pick up 30 to 32 barrels. What would they have done then without this other system?
They'd have been shut down until they could figure out some way to get it off, and that's
now. There was another barge that was anchored a little further out. What was that barge?
That barge was there by put there by Exxon for the purpose of taking the oil out of the skimmers.
Why was that not being utilized?
Because they didn't have a pumping system to get the oil out of the skimmers.
How long did that barge remain there in an inoperative fashion?
For certain, at least
I
a
was
week.
There on
for
day
certain,
two.
At least a week, and I believe it was almost 2 weeks.
The barge sat there for 2 weeks and had no ability to offload the, wasn't for the purposes of storing the oil that was being skimmed from the water?
That's correct.
But did the pumps ever arrive?
They had pumps on board. It's just that they weren't able to deal with the weight and the heaviness that weathered oil. They used auger. They tried auger pumps. There were several different pumps that they were attempting to use, and it was only been, I think it was in the late into the third week that they finally came up with a method of being able to do to pump off those skimmers that was successful with any degree of speed.
So eventually that barge was pressed into service.
That's correct.
And that was some 3 weeks after the...
If I'm not mistaken, that barge was utilized to offload the Long Harbor, which the Super Sucker was on, and the Super Sucker, I think, used some of its own facilities to provide that transfer.
Well, I guess the thing that caught my attention out there was, one, how hard the fishermen and others were working to seine the oil back out to the entrance of Sawmill Bay, and then wait, of course, for the change of tides and start that whole process over. And it appeared, obviously, you were doing that on a 24-hour basis, day after day, because you did not have the capability to provide any coherent skimming, offloading, and removal of the oil from the surface of the water. And again, it just kind of takes me back to the contingency plan, where there is this strong representation that somehow you'd be able to manage this, and what you see is that if you remove the fishermen from the scene, and obviously the contingency plan expects to use fishermen and their vessels and what have you, but if you had removed the fishermen from the scene at Sawmill Bay, you would have had a skimmer that would have picked up 32 barrels of oil and then been stuck. And apparently would have been stuck for a considerable period. Use fishermen and their vessels and what have you. But if you had removed the fishermen from the scene at Sawmill Bay, you would have had a skimmer that would have picked up 32 barrels of oil and then been stuck. And apparently would have been stuck for a considerable period.